good to see you again. I was here the last round, but new colleagues.
Yeah, I will tell you, it was a true honor and a treat to be able to sit in the courtroom this morning and hear that first argument. We don't get to see a lot of that background from, and it was truly enjoyable. So thanks, and happy to be back.
This one's complicated too.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, that's what makes it kind of fun. I guess it's still morning. So good morning. My name is David Boudet. I'm with the law firm of Miller Johnson. I represent Allied Mechanical Services in this matter. But with me today is my partner, Keith Eastland. The central issue in this case is whether there is substantial evidence in this record to support the board's finding of 9A status. Under this court's decisions in Nova Plumbing and in M&M Backhoe, such a finding must be established by actual evidence that a majority of AMS's employees supported the union.
So, I'm not sure you're reading, or I think you're over-reading NOVA, aren't you?
I don't think so, no.
I thought, I didn't see that the holding in NOVA is as you just stated.
The holding in this case was based on those circumstances, but the general proposition...
actual evidence in NOVA that the... union did not have a majority status at the time of alleged recognition.
Well, the evidence on the record, frankly, was very similar to the evidence record here. The only record evidence here concerning majority status.
No. Here you have an absence. There you had an actual indication that the union did not have a majority.
Well, no. You also have the testimony of Dan Huizenga, the treasurer at the.
NOVA or this case?
In this case, Dan Huizenga testified, who's the treasurer of AMS, without contradiction, that the union had never, ever shown that a majority of his people supported the union.
That's a separate issue. In this case, you have two hypotheticals. The first of which is you have a demand for recognition and an offer to show majority status, which an employer says, hypothetically, it's not necessary, I believe you. And the second, and then there's subsequent evidence that the union doesn't have a majority within, let's say it comes up within a month. And that's a Bernhardt case in the Supreme Court case, that the recognition is, even if it's in good faith, it's an unfair labor practice, right? But we're dealing here with a question where you have a demand for recognition, the hypothetical is closer to the demand for recognition, an offer to show, and no examination.
Well, Your Honor, that is not what we have here. What we have here is a settlement agreement that everybody agrees is the basis of that.
What about my hypothetical? You have a demand for recognition, an offer to show, the employer says, no, it's not necessary. Do you read NOVA? If in the construction industry, that is that can be challenged at any time, even though the employer doesn't challenge it at the time of recognition?
No, I read Nova Plumbing is saying that the offer of proof is not enough, the intent of the parties is not enough, the contract language is not enough, but, Your Honor,
you're not dealing with my hypothetical.
No, to your point, you are right, though, that that under settled law, if there, in fact, if there was a showing or an offer.
No, there's a demand for recognition or an offer to show, the employer says it's not necessary.
Says it's not necessary.
Unnecessary, I believe you.
That's NOVA.
That is, NOVA actually has extra evidence in it that, however, there's indication the union did not have a majority.
But in this case also, there's evidence the union had a majority.
Well, there's not. It's not NOVA.
I agree it's not.
Specific evidence in NOVA, and Judge Silberman's right, our tradition is in that circumstance, you may later face an unfair labor practice and lose if it turns out there was no majority, but if an employer is, a demand is made and the employer recognizes the union and they proceed, that's not unlawful. Supreme Court said in Bernhardt, but if we catch you later, you know, we're going to tell you, no, that's not acceptable, and that's that. But in this case, it's worse than that in this case because it was a 1991, I don't know what you all are talking about, collective bargaining agreement. That's not a collective bargaining agreement. There was a refusal to bargain charge. So the board is assuming, they don't bring those charges unless they assume there's a majority. So we have to assume that they're acting honestly and faithfully. That is, they're bringing a charge and the employer settles and says, okay, I agree to bargain. I don't know how that becomes an 8F. There's no 8F here. That's a 9A.
It's funny to me how you say how that becomes a 9A to me when you...
No, how that becomes an 8F.
How does it become a 9A?
Well, the board is accusing the employer of refusing to bargain. 9A. The board doesn't accuse an employer of refusing to bargain on an 8F.
Well, they do accuse employers of bargaining for failure to comply with a settlement agreement, where that duty emanates from a settlement agreement.
The original refusal, at least unless I have the facts wrong, the original charge came before all of this, and the employer settled it.
That's correct.
Okay, and the underlying premise of the original refusal of bargain was the union should be recognized as a lawful bargaining agent.
That was an allegation and a complaint that was denied.
And the employer settled it and said, I will bargain. Let me tell you what's bothering me. So the employer in that posture, that's a 9A posture. There's no 8F anything so far.
You could have an 8F. You could have a refusal to bargain under 8F, but only if there's a violation of a collective bargaining agreement.
Of an 8F agreement. There is no, wait, let me just finish it. So you have a 9A, you have a 9A foundation.
Yes.
Okay. The employer settles it and says, okay, I will now bargain. The employer doesn't say, I'm going to bargain as an 8F. Employer says, I will now bargain as a 9A. I don't, and there is no agreement. There's no collective bargaining agreement in this case. That 91, whatever it was not a collective bargaining agreement. So how is 8F in here?
Well, 8F, if you go back to the settlement agreement, it doesn't specify what it is. And so in the agreement, there's a non-admission clause. What you're suggesting, Judge Edgeworth, is that by settling, AMS capitulated to the complaint that was made, that it admitted to the allegations that there was majority status, that it admitted to that it engaged in GISL-type unfair labor practices, and that therefore it entered into a 9A relationship. The problem with that theory put forth by the general counsel is there's no facts to support that. The settlement agreement.
But the problem with your theory, which is resting heavily on the notion of 8F, there's nothing to suggest there's an 8F arrangement here.
Well, let me back up a little bit. The argument that's being made by the general counsel as it relates to the position you're putting forth as it relates to collateral estoppel, right? They're saying
Put aside the collateral estoppel question.
Okay.
That's a complicated issue. Put it aside.
Still complicated.
Judge Edwards is asking you, as I read the settlement agreement, it could only be based on 9A because the allegations were only 9A kind of allegations. There was no 8F kind of allegation. Under an 8F arrangement, the only claim of 8A5 could be raised based on a violation of an 8F agreement. But this is much broader. This says the employer was independently bargaining with the union, with the employees, circumventing the union, doing all kinds of allegations like that. That absolutely sounds like the classic 9A situation and not an 8F.
Well, there's three grounds in which this bargaining relationship can be based. 8A, 9A, which is what the general counsel and everyone's talking about here. 8F, which AMS, and by the way, the administrative law judge found in this case, it's not crazy cockamamie idea. The third thing is the settlement agreement itself.
All right, now wait. Let me stop you to make sure I understand you. When you say the administrative law judge found an 8F agreement?
He found that we are an 8F employer and there's an 8F agreement.
No, wait.
He found that the settlement agreement was an 8F agreement, yes.
It's nonsense. It's not a collective bargaining agreement.
But the statute itself, Your Honor, says 8F says an agreement.
An agreement.
It doesn't say...
It's not a collective bargaining
and
agreement.
And there are no cases, Your Honor. You've seen all the briefs in here. Neither the union nor the general counsel has cited to one case where the NLRB has said the term an agreement means a collective bargaining agreement.
Know why? It's so obvious. No one would ever dispute that. It's axiomatic. We're talking about a collective
bargaining
agreement.
But even if we're
wrong... When you look at the structure, I mean, this is one of those no-brainers. When you look at the structure of the Act and what 8F is about, we're talking about a collective bargaining agreement being okay for a time, and you can't be challenged even if there's a minority, and then you can walk away from it. That's it. You don't have a collective bargaining agreement here, an 8F agreement.
I disagree, but assume that's even true. That doesn't answer the underlying question as to what is the basis for this bargaining relationship. because there's still a third basis that hasn't been discovered, and that's the contractual basis. That is, the settlement agreement itself has been found, 1950 in the Poole decision cited by us, the Fourth Circuit affirming the board decision. In that case, you had a 9A employer and an expired collective bargaining agreement. At the time the contract expired, after that, 97% of the employees came forward to the employer and handed the employer a petition saying, we want the union out. By statute, by the National Labor Relations Act, the Fourth Circuit recognizes, the board recognizes, that employer at that point in time was free to walk away.
Mm-hmm.
And the employer walked away. And they filed an unfair labor practice charge. And the board found, and the Fourth Circuit affirmed, that there was a bargaining obligation that came out of the settlement agreement with very similar language to ours. So they imposed that bargaining obligation, regardless of this legal status, the 9A status, it had to do with the settlement agreement. So when this charge is settled with a non-admission clause, in accordance with BPH, it means what it says. If they wanted it to be 9A, the regional director certainly understood the difference between 8F and 9A and could have put that in there.
Your obligation under the settlement agreement?
To bargain just like the employer in Poole. Just like the employer in Poole.
Right.
I'm sorry?
To bargain in good faith?
For a reasonable period of time. That is correct.
Right. And that's classic 9A, isn't it?
It's
not 8F.
No, but it doesn't.
8F is not, you don't have an obligation under 8F to bargain for a reasonable period of time.
Sure, once you have an agreement, you do. Once you have an agreement.
Don't have it. That's the point. You know where we're going. That's the problem. There is no agreement.
There is an agreement. The settlement agreement is an agreement, Your Honor.
Oh.
But even if it's wrong, who bears the burden here? Isn't there a presumption in the construction industry of an 8A status? That's an 8F status, I'm sorry? There's a presumption of 8F status in the construction industry.
So done.
The board?
That if you're in the construction industry, it's always 8F?
No, there's a presumption. There's a presumption of 8F status, and that presumption must be overcome by the party that carries the burden of proof. And in this case, the party that bears the burden of proof
only,
here.
The only strength of your argument, I'm going to ask the board, I mean, the strength of your argument is, do we have to worry about the finding of a majority at any point anywhere? This is not Nova because they positively found no majority. The weakness in your argument is trying to hook it on 8F. There is no 8F here. You can't make that up. I don't care what the ALJ said. There was no 8F agreement because there was no collective bargaining agreement. The board never premised its charge on 8F. They were premising it on 9A, obviously, and you agreed to bargain.
But the general counsel has the burden of proof here to say, where is the evidence on the record that there's a 9A? And you're saying the settlement agreement creates a 9A relationship? It creates a 9A relationship based on allegations and a complaint that are denied?
You're saying...
You agreed.
Yes.
No, we agreed to the settlement.
But we agreed to bargain. Did we
not? Yes, you agreed to bargain.
And you can agree, we all agree that a voluntary recognition of a union can be done under 8F and it can be done under 9A. It would be entirely lawful for AMS to have bargained with the union. And that still doesn't get to the burden. That's what the general counsel is trying to do, is flip this thing upside down. It's his burden.
Charge under 8F where there's no agreement, never has been one, and say you're refusing to bargain with the union under 8F?
I'm sorry?
Can the board file that such a charge and say you're refusing to bargain under 8F?
Well, in Schwickert, you had the board, on a terminated 8F agreement, say...
You don't like to stay with our hypotheticals. It's clean. There was nothing before. Can the board file a charge under 8F and say there's a refusal to bargain? Absolutely not.
But in this case...
There's no such case.
But in this case, they could have reinstated the charges in this case because we had a settlement agreement.
But you couldn't have a Gissel case under 8F.
Right.
You could not possibly have a Gissel claim under 8F because Gissel depends on the proposition that the union had a majority at some point and the employer's unfair labor practices dissipated it.
Once the majority is established and proven in court, correct? It wasn't proven.
No. That's the claim that's made.
It couldn't possibly
have been proceeded under 8F.
Sure they could.
Because 8F doesn't need a majority status at all.
Well, sure they could have proceeded under 8F because, under 9A. They could have proceeded mistakenly. The regional director does not know at the time, oftentimes, they do this for a living, Your Honor, the regional director is given information from one side of the equation, the union, and oftentimes the union is wrong about the size of the bargaining unit.
All right,
and if you're wrong about the size of the bargaining unit, your allegation of majority support may be wrong.
All right, well, let's assume
the list of the employees that the union, we don't have any of this on the record. I have no idea how they determined majority status in that case. It was never litigated.
But
it was denied.
But that's the premise of the settlement agreement. That's the problem with your position.
And the problem is
it has a non-admission clause, right?
Correct. And BPH says that the settlement agreement should mean what it says. Read it. Where does it say 8F? Where does it say 9A? It says neither.
No.
Whose burden is it?
You don't have a case on 8F. You have an interesting question you've raised, and you didn't brief it
that way.
The interesting question is, there isn't a majority anywhere. No one's ever found a majority anywhere, and we're entitled to that finding. But you muddled it up with all this 8F nonsense, and 8F isn't in the case. It's a make-believe. It's silly, because the board could not have come in the first instance in this case and premised its charge on 8F. And even though they couldn't, you're now resting on that, which makes no sense.
But they
could argue that there's never been, it was 9A, but just as Barnhart says, you can voluntarily recognize a union and then found to be in violation of the law if there really isn't a majority. Now, if you played it out that way, then we'd have to scratch our heads. What do we do here? But that's not the theory you've raised.
But that we did raise that theory, maybe not, obviously not well enough and clearly enough. But in our brief, we did say there was a third basis. This basis, what you're suggesting, I don't know the Barnhart case, I'm sorry, Your Honor, but the idea in Poole is what we cited. In Poole is the same idea. There's this other way to have a bargaining obligation, whether it's 9A or 8F, that's based on a settlement agreement. And so for an 8A5 violation, all you need is a bargaining obligation. That's what you need, right? You need a bargaining obligation. A bargaining obligation can be and was created, everybody agrees in this courtroom, by the settlement agreement. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that's 9A.
Doesn't mean it's 8F.
Doesn't, but who bears the burden?
The problem is if
that's where it comes back to.
The problem that we're raising for you is it's not as easy as you're suggesting. What we're suggesting is you could not have reasonably assumed when you signed that settlement agreement that 8F was in play. You could not have, because that's not a charge the board could have brought. It could not have brought that charge. There's no such thing.
Excuse me, Judge. The best argument you have is the backhoe case. Isn't that
right? M&M. Yeah, where this court restates the rule, yes.
The problem with backhoe is, number one, it's dicta, and number two, it misstates NOVA.
I think the premise for NOVA equally applies here. People said what this court, I think, said in NOVA, at least the foundation of it's the same. It's the Section 7 rights of the employees. And the employees in AMS have the same Section 7 rights as the employees in backhoe, the same as in NOVA plumbing. And they haven't had a voice in this. And that's the underlying concern here. And whether or not it's because the regional director made a mistake.
The principle of law you're arguing for is if it's a construction employer and a construction union, there is always a presumption of an 8F relationship. And therefore, the employer can disregard or abrogate the relationship once a contract expires at will. And at that point, it's up to the general counsel must show majority status as a positive matter.
Correct.
And that would treat construction unions entirely different and more unfavorably than any other unions. But that's your proposition.
Why would they be treated any differently?
Because that wouldn't be the law with respect to a non-construction union. Because the law is, I think correctly as I stated, that if an employer recognizes that union based on an offer of showing of cards, and he does not look at the cards or she does not look at the cards, that employer cannot subsequently challenge the union's majority status on the grounds the union never affirmatively showed majority status.
No, that's not true. They can challenge that, but they have a 10B time period in which to do that, Your Honor.
Yes.
But they can challenge it. They have 6 months to do that.
Well, wait a minute.
Under present, that's
about to be reversed by the board under
I'm not going to disagree with that.
I know the board rule that you're regarding that came in a few years ago, but that has never been endorsed by the courts.
But that's the general idea is you have that.
The law that I described has been the general law of the courts of appeals and indeed the Supreme Court.
The fundamental issue, I think, that makes this line up with M&M Backhoe and NOVA Plumbing is that there is no evidence ever of majority support. I don't believe.
Are you correctly to say that if an employer recognizes a union based on an offer of showing of cards, and the employer says, I believe you, and then 3 months later, he says, no, I'm going to refuse the bargain anymore because you didn't show 3 months ago that you had a majority.
You can act, they can do that. In fact, if they're right, then they get the withdrawal even in a 9A situation.
You have to show evidence. The employer would have to show evidence that at the time he recognized it was wrong, the union did not have a majority.
I don't think
put the burden at that point on the union after to go back and show 3 months ago that it had the majority staff.
Sure you could. Sure you can go back, Your Honor. Your Honor, if you have a good faith belief as
employer could come up with evidence, I agree. But he couldn't just refuse on the grounds that the union didn't show me a majority 3 months.
I see what you're saying, right? You have to have some belief that there's not a majority. I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, you can't just.
That's the problem with your case, it seems to me.
No, because in this case, there, you keep presuming that there's some evidence that doesn't exist. Where is this evidence?
Of a hypothetical.
To go back to your example, Your Honor.
Judge Edwards and I see the settlement agreement essentially as a recognition.
A recognition to bargain, just like in Poole.
Recognition of majority status, and therefore.
Where does it say that?
Well, because if you didn't have majority status, then you would be
in violation of the law.
No,
yes.
indeed, Judge Edwards, it is perfectly permissible for a construction industry employer to bargain with a union that does not have majority status.
Well,
so no, you would not be in violation of law.
It's an 8F agreement, which is a pre-hire agreement.
Under your theory, what you're saying, under that theory, then what you're saying is a construction industry employer, as they bargain the pre-hire agreement, as they bargain the collective bargaining agreement, before they is engaging in illegal activity because the construction industry.
No.
That was the premise.
The employer, under an 8F, you really have two steps for an agreement. Number one, you have a pre-hire agreement, and then you have a collective bargaining agreement.
Your Honor.
They are merged.
Oftentimes they're merged, yes.
The pre-hire and the collective
Correct.
Bargaining agreement. But you could have it in two steps.
Sure.
But the key to an 8F agreement is the pre-hire agreement, which would never be allowed under Section 9. It's illegal under Section 9.
Sure.
Okay.
So
Judge Edwards is absolutely correct. You don't have the slightest indication of an 8F agreement.
Well, let's go back to Poole. In Poole, that employer not only was not deemed to be unlawful, it had a terminated collective bargaining agreement, had 97% of the employees saying, I don't support this union. And the court said, you got to bargain because of the settlement agreement. So let's take this case.
But you had a pre-existing agreement there, right?
They had agreement that terminated, right? Expired is probably a better word. It expired and been terminated by the parties.
Same case.
It's not identical, but the same principles apply here. Where does the general counsel meet its burden of showing? It's not our burden to prove 8F, which seems to be the thing that we seem to be hung up on here, is that the employer can't prove 8F, therefore it must be 9A.
There's no indication of 8F.
Yeah, it's not a matter of burden.
Not a burden of proof. There's not a shred of evidence that it's 8F.
Nothing.
Well,
zero.
There's a settlement agreement. There's a fact that there's even an employee in the construction, a union in the construction industry.
That's it.
You have 8F that says it's an agreement. This idea that it has to be a collective bargaining agreement is, I know that Judge Edwards strongly disagrees with me and he's the one making the decision, but the bottom line is, it doesn't say that, and there's no cases that say that. You'd see them cited.
Why don't we give the board a
thank you.
Chance.
May it please the court, my name is Steve Goldstein, attorney for the National Labor Relations Board, which is seeking enforcement of its order. The board found, first of all, very quickly, that the company violated the act by refusing to hire 4 job applicants because of the union membership and by refusing to reinstate 10 strikers. The board's entitled to summary enforcement of those findings because the company doesn't contest them before the court. And the board also found that the company violated the act by withdrawing recognition from the union, making unilateral change, and refusing to furnish information. And since the company admits that it did do those things, the question before the court is whether the board had a reasonable basis for finding that the parties had a 9A relationship.
Where's the evidence of majority support? Our cases, as I read them, require that, and I don't see it.
Okay, well, as the questions have indicated, outside the construction industry, an employer may recognize the union based on the union's assertion of majority support without extrinsic evidence of majority support. And as the board has explained, a rule that would hold that a construction industry employer cannot do that would contravene DECLA's fundamental principle that construction industry unions should not be entitled to less favorable treatment.
But our cases, the board doesn't agree with our cases. I understand that.
Okay.
But they bind me.
Okay. Well, as we discuss at length in our brief, as the court's already indicated,
prior oral argument where I was with you as well. I
okay. The absence of evidence that the union has a majority is not the same thing as evidence that the union lacks a majority. Nova Plumbing, by its own terms, merely stands for the limited proposition that standing alone, contract language and intent can't be dispositive, at least where there's strong indications.
If the M&M language, if we follow that, do you lose?
Well, I don't think so. With respect, M&M ignored all the limiting language of Nova Plumbing. But even if M&M got Nova right, courts only decide issues presented to them. And the issue presented
I understand that it's dicta. If we follow it, because we think we have to follow it, whatever you call it, do you lose?
I don't think we do, because this case, Nova Plumbing explained that if a private agreement between an employer and a union were sufficient to establish 9A status without extrinsic evidence of majority support, then employers and unions could collude at the expense of employees and foist unwanted minority unions on employees and moreover give it insulated 9A status. But in our case, there's no possibility of collusion because our case does not involve a private agreement between an employer and a union. Instead, it involves a regional director-approved settlement agreement. So the context in which the bargaining obligation arises in our case is totally different from that which exists
the
in
only
Nova
election
or
M&M. That, the only election that ever occurred, a majority rejected.
True, but that election was in 1986. The grant of recognition here was in 1990.
The only thing we have, the only election that ever occurred, a majority rejected.
Well, sure, but again.
And then there was a proposal in 1995 that makes no sense whatsoever if it was assumed as a result of the settlement
Let me deal with them one at a time. I mean, not every union campaign, or not every political candidate is like Harold Stassen, who runs over and over again and keeps losing. Nixon lost an election in 1960. He won in 68 and 72. The fact that the union lost an election in 1986 certainly does show that the union lacked majority support in 86. It certainly does not show that the union lacked majority support in 1990.
No evidence of majority support. And what about the 95 proposal?
Okay, well, again.
Does that make any sense if everyone's thinking they have a 9A relationship?
Well, as the board explained in its decision, parties make bargaining proposals for all sorts of reasons. The union might have been so desperate to get a collective bargaining agreement at that point that was willing to accept one with a lesser recognition provision. The fact that they were willing to accept the collective bargaining agreement with an 8F provision in 1995 certainly does not prove that they agreed that they had gotten recognition in 1990 under 8F. And as Judge Edwards' question makes sense, and as the board explained, 8F imposes no enforceable obligations in the absence of a collective bargaining agreement. The board could not have alleged the violations that it alleged in this case unless the employer were a 9A, had a 9A relationship, because there's never been a collective bargaining agreement. All the settlement cases upon which the company relies, they all involve unions that were certified. When you're certified, by definition, you're a 9A representative, and therefore the settlement agreement in those cases could give rise to an obligation to bargain. I have never seen a case, and none has been cited, where you had a settlement agreement in an 8F context that imposed an obligation to bargain. This settlement agreement wouldn't have been worth the paper it was printed on because it wouldn't have been enforceable. Now, just very briefly, one of the bases for the board's finding that it was a 9A relationship is that the language in the recognition agreement attracts the language in board orders finding.
You mean the settlement agreement?
Yes.
Okay.
In 9A.
And a recognition agreement, but anyway, I'll take the.
I'm sorry, the recognition portion of the settlement agreement attracts the language in board orders in 9A cases rather than the more limited language in 8F cases. The company argues in its reply brief that simply isn't true, that the board uses the same kind of language, but the company waived that argument by not raising it in its opening brief, and in any event, it simply lacks merit. It cites only two cases. The first case is Kodiak. It's true that in the conclusion of law section of that case, the board said the union is the exclusive rep. But in the very same sentence, the board said within the meaning of Section 8F. So you certainly wouldn't see that kind of language in a 9A case.
Does the settlement agreement say that the union has majority support?
No, it does not. The only other case the company cites is Schwickerts of Rochester, but that case involved an employer, unlike the company, that had been party to a series of collective bargaining agreements and that was bargaining on a multi-employer basis. And it's well settled that employers have less freedom to withdraw recognition when they're bargaining on a multi-employer basis than when they're bargaining on a single-employer basis. Indeed, footnote 19 of Schwickerts makes clear that if the employers had not been bound to multi-employer bargaining, they would have been free to change the terms and conditions of employment once the contract expired. The other major point I'd like to make is that the company argues vociferously that the board should not have been allowed to rely on the language of the settlement agreement in determining the nature of the recognition extended because the settlement agreement contains a non-admissions clause. But we don't have a BPH problem here because BPH merely stands for the limited proposition that the board can't rely on a settlement agreement in one case to prove that the employer committed unfair labor practices in that case if the settlement agreement contained a non-admissions clause. In our case, the board's not relying on the settlement agreement to prove that the employer committed unfair labor practices in the case that it settled. Instead, the board's merely relying on the settlement agreement to determine the nature of the recognition extended. And it's not an unfair labor practice for an employer to recognize a union as the 9A rep, even in the absence of unfair labor practices. If the company didn't want the...
With the uncertainty that we have about what was going on, doesn't the presumption of 8F kick in?
The presumption is that collective bargaining agreements in the construction industry are 8F. I don't think there's any presumption that, broadly speaking, that a collective bargaining relationship in the absence...
There's dispute about what was going on in 1991, what the nature of the agreement and relationship was. And there is a presumption of 8F status. I take your point. This is... Maybe you can distinguish it on that basis, but...
8F agreement.
Well, again, I mean, I don't think there was any basis for a reasonable person to think that it was anything other than 9A because the union demanded recognition.
I don't know what they were doing in 95 then.
Excuse me?
I don't know what they were doing in 1995 then with that proposal in 1995.
Didn't the union ask for both 9A?
It's true, Your Honor. As the board also stated in its decision.
They asked for both.
Right, and at different times.
This is going on so long, we'll take anything.
I think that's a fair inference.
But if you already have 9A, why are you asking for anything?
Because with a collective bargaining agreement, you're entitled to an irrebuttable presumption of majority status during the term of a collective bargaining agreement of 3 years or less. If you don't have a collective bargaining agreement, even in the 9A context, you're only entitled to a rebuttable presumption.
Counsel, with respect to backup, what about the concern that Judge Kavanaugh raised as to whether we're bound to BACO's interpretation of NOVA?
Well, I think what you could say, I think what I've tried to say here is that even if M&M got NOVA right, courts only decide issues presented to them. The problem in NOVA, and as interpreted by M&M, was that if you're just talking about a private agreement between an employer and a union, there's a possibility for collusion. But in our case, we're not talking about a private.
You in the footnote, did you in a footnote in your brief, you really went after BACO, pointing out that it was dicta in that case because there was a direct finding contrary to the statement it made about NOVA, and
yes.
In any event, it was incorrect about NOVA.
Yes, yes. I'm sorry if I misunderstood your question.
So why did you put that in a footnote? That was an important point.
Well, I apologize if I should have put it in the text.
I don't understand why counsel would take an issue that important, which you're going to get hit with, and drop it in a footnote.
Well, I think, I mean, again, I apologize for not putting it in the text, but if you look at the...
Having many years ago argued cases for the general counsel's office, I remember the device of trying to put major issues in footnotes,
okay.
And that's it's an unwise brief writing.
I'll try to follow your advice in the future. If I could just return just for 1 second to the importance of the settlement.
Why aren't you making the point that you're entitled to deference, the board's entitled to deference with respect to its interpretation of the settlement agreement? We have so held before that agencies are entitled to deference with respect to interpretation of settlement agreements brought before them. Now, here the settlement agreement is between the general counsel, which is not the board, and the petitioner in this case. So the board is interpreting that settlement agreement, and even if it were ambiguous, why aren't you entitled to deference on that?
Well, we are, but I think the company would argue that a settlement agreement, like any other kind of agreement, is a contract, and it's a contract.
Oh, don't give away your deference argument, because we have so held that an agency is entitled to deference with respect to interpretation of settlement agreements, as long as the agency itself is not a party to the settlement agreement, that it's part of its regulatory role. And that's exactly this case. Okay. The general counsel is the is an entirely separate party than the NLRB.
This might be a variation on the same thing, but the board certainly did say here that it's entitled to deference in determining whether the language of the settlement agreement comports with the language in board orders in 9A cases. And
very close, right. That's close.
Right. So again, the existence of the settlement agreement eliminates the possibility for collusion here that animated the court in Nova. So even if, you know, we're wrong about M&M being dicta, even if we're wrong about M&M misinterpreting Nova, you could still leave that line of cases in place and enforce our decision here.
We could, I suppose, but I don't like, think of a neutral term here, getting around prior decisions of prior panels.
Well, I think then the answer is, and this came up in the Ninth Circuit, I think, when Judge Kennedy was still a circuit judge, with respect to the test for determining the legality of interrogations. I mean, a subsequent panel sitting as a panel, not en banc, can't reverse, you know.
I get it, whether it's departing from the prior case or just interpreting the prior case, but that's not a recipe for a collegial body.
Well, one of the luxuries about being an appellate counsel instead of a judge is that I don't have to figure out what's the best way to do that. The remaining issues, I think we've adequately addressed in our brief.
Thank you. Appreciate the argument.
Thank you.
2 minutes for rebuttal, if you want it.
Yeah, sure. quick points first.
Why isn't the board entitled to deference with respect to interpretation of this settlement agreement?
Because they are a party to it.
No. The general counsel is the party, not the board.
I don't know of any cases that would provide deference to the
We've so held in several cases. One in Bob and FERC case.
That they would imply terms such as that don't exist in the agreement because deference is to create words in the agreement that don't exist?
You know, if you have an ambiguous settlement agreement put before an agency, and an agency interprets it in a particular way, we defer to the right. If it's an ambiguous interpretation, now some of us don't think it was so ambiguous, but even if it was ambiguous.
I don't think it's ambiguous either. I think it's absent in this thing. I agree with you. I don't think it is. And I think going back to Nova, that's, I guess, the point I'd like to stress on rebuttal. The strong indications. That was the phrase the court used. There were strong indications, and therefore you required proof of majority status. And there are strong indications here as well. And first and foremost, it goes back to the argument just raised. AMS can only appeal and act on the decision that the NLRB has made. The board decision in this case does not distinguish Nova and does not make any of the arguments put forth here. It doesn't say, well, Nova's different because. It simply ignored Nova. That wasn't a basis for the decision. The board has lost that ability to now make that here today.
No. Wait a minute. Just because the board decision doesn't refer to Nova, that doesn't stop the general, the appellate lawyer defending the board from arguing that Nova is not binding in this case. That's a legal argument. That's an argument with respect to an interpretation of a case, which we've never thought of as a separate legal argument. We've specifically so held, as a matter of fact.
You put forth a theory. You put forth the theory to the, as AMS did to the NLRB in its motion for reconsideration, and they simply ignore it. They don't address it in any way and say, no, Staunton Feel is the rule, and Staunton Feel is what we need to apply here. That's what's up on appeal. That's the standard that they apply. They didn't say, hey, Nova Plumbing is distinguishable.
They don't have to. They don't have to acquiesce in a particular appellate opinion.
Correct.
They have a perfect right to refuse to acquiesce.
Sure.
But that doesn't take away their ability to argue in this court that Nova is distinguishable and doesn't provide them with negative precedent.
Correct, but the rationale, once that's based, has to be reach back to the underlying decision itself. They can distinguish it, but you got to reach back to the underlying decision. Sure. Otherwise, how are we as a party supposed to know what the basis of the board's decision is that we're appealing to you? I mean, just like we have, just like Mr. Goldstein suggesting that we waive some argument. The idea, I mean, this circuit's been very particular about the types of notices parties have to give to each other before they get up here. But even, I'm running out of time again, let me get through this quickly. The other, I think, strong indications, as Judge Kavanaugh referenced, is the admission in 1995 of the union. And Judge Edward, what the proposal was, is they said that they were an 8F employer, and then if they got a majority, they would then go convert to a 9A. That was the proposal, which again, I think, is an admission in this case. And then the underlying, again, premise of NOVA, I believe, equally applies to the employees of AMS, and that is they have their same Section 7 rights. And so I think that is also a strong indication. And then the last point I want to refer back to the opinion of NOVA. The questions we've got is there have been statements made that in NOVA there was a finding that the employees, the majority of employees, did not support the union. I just went back and looked at it. That was not my recollection, and again, I'm doing this quick, but I believe if you look at page 537 of the opinion, the factual account is not that finding at all. Instead, it says that although the ALJ did not permit a full showing on actual majority support, uncontradicted testimony indicates that even senior employees who had been longtime union members opposed the union's representation. And then it gives examples. It does not say that the evidence was that a majority of them did not support it. And that's why I think another strong indication is this testimony of Dan Huizenga. It is, again, this testimony, I believe, was from the president of NOVA Plumbing that this court relied on. It was similar, very similar in nature. So when it comes to, I think, the binding nature of it, that's where we got that from. Again, and I think that's an important fact here.
Yes, go board counsel.
Sure. Yes.
Respond to that last point.
I just don't think that's true. I mean, in NOVA Plumbing, the courts, there were several pieces of evidence to support the NOVA Plumbing Court's conclusion that there were strong indications that the parties had only an 8F relationship. The evidence was as follows. The president of the company testified that he did not think the union had a majority when he signed the recognition agreement. Two, there was evidence that the employees rebelled when they were told about the recognition.
That first one's ambiguous.
It is. But the most significant piece was that there was actually testimony from a union witness who was the one who solicited cards, who visited the job sites. He testified that he could only remember three employees signing cards. That would be a minority.
Only remembered?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, both counsel, for a lively argument. Adjourned.